Good morning. Keep your Bibles open there to Joshua chapter 6, and that's where our lesson comes from this morning, mainly. So if you will, keep your Bible open there, put your marker there in Joshua 6. I'd like to talk about Jericho this morning. If you are one of the kids in our Bible story Zoom on Thursday morning, we read this chapter together. So you've seen some of these pictures already, and we've talked about it. Now we're going to break it up open for everybody as we talk about what happened at Jericho. Glad you're here this morning and are joining us either online or in person. Here in the book of Joshua, it records the conquest of Canaan. Israel is invading this land that God had promised originally back to Abraham, way back in Genesis 12 and verse 7. And now years and years later, centuries later, here it's coming to fruition. And the children of Israel, with God's help, of course, as they obey God, God is granting them this land and kicking the evil people out. And here they are fulfilling that original promise to Abraham. The book of Joshua begins with God telling Joshua through Moses, be strong and courageous, and that he would be able to conquer this land as it was promised to the fathers. So you might remember the story where God stops the Jordan River. They cross formally, I guess, into the promised land, and the first city on the list is Jericho. So obeying God's conditions would cause the walls of Jericho to fall down. It's a great story. Victory in this battle as they conquer this first city after they cross over the Jordan, and it's one of the more memorable events of the Old Testament. Well, what's important to us is that there are lessons in it that are still relevant under the New Covenant, and that's what we're going to look at this morning. So let's start by just reading through Joshua chapter 6 together. We've already read the first five verses, thanks to Luke, so let's pick it up in verse 6. It says that Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And then he said to the people, go forward and march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord. And it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark while they continued to blow the trumpets. Here's the modern site that they are pretty sure is the ancient site of Jericho, and it's now called Tell es Sultan. Tell is the Arabic word for mound, and so here's where the archaeologists go and dig in these old dirt mounds to look for ruins and see what they can find. And they found this site that has a lot of indicators, location including and walls that have fallen down that makes us pretty sure that this is the ancient site of Jericho, this Tell es Sultan. There's the top view. It looks like there's still a lot to dig up, but it's actually the second most excavated city right behind Jerusalem. So there's been a lot of digs here for over 100 years at Tell es Sultan. Here's just a picture of a guy mimicking what they're doing there as we read the priests blowing these trumpets. Here's one I've got, this ram. I'm not going to blow it. Don't get excited. But you can imagine these priests, they're going around and they're blowing these horns as they are marching around the city. Then they're going to blow them again on the seventh day. There's a remake in a museum of the Ark of the Covenant, this special item that God had them make by his instructions back in the book of Exodus, had these poles. When they were doing it the right way, they were carrying it on their shoulders and the poles, certain guys. So all of this, imagine marching around the city of Jericho. All right, verse 10. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I tell you shout, then you shall shout. So he had the Ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once, and they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came after the Ark of the Lord while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did so for 6 days. So you can imagine, here's an old picture from above the city. You can imagine them just marching around each day and then going back to their camp and camping at night. Here's a picture of, maybe how far away from the city where they would have been. So you can imagine this would be the views of the Israelites as they're marching around the city, except instead of mounds, it was a walled city, of course, at that time. That back in verse 15, so then on the seventh day, they rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. Only on that day, they marched around the city seven times. At the seventh time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord, so they shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted and priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and oxen, sheep, and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Okay, so again, imagine the Israelites rushing into the city once the walls came crashing down. There is another overhead picture of the ancient site there. This is an archaeologist, Bryant Wood, who is, I think, the most recent guy who's done a lot of digging and study and excavation over there, pointing to a collapsed mud brick wall section underneath the layers of dirt there. And then in verse 22, it says, Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all that she has out of there, as you have sworn to her. So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. And they also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. One of the interesting things about this site is a section over here, and I don't have any better picture of it than this one. But back in Joshua 2:15, it says that Rahab's house was on the city wall, on the city wall. And then here, of course, as we've just read, they are supposed to go into the harlot's house and bring her out with her family. Archaeologist Bryant Wood, who was just on that slide a second ago, has suggested Rahab's house may have been on the northern side of the city. He writes, the German excavation of 1907 to 1909 found that on the north, a short stretch of the lower city wall did not fall, as everywhere else. A portion of that mud brick wall was still standing to a height of 8 feet. What is more, there were houses built against the wall. It is quite possible that this is where Rahab's house was located. So that's an interesting thing. Now, remember, archaeology is kind of an inexact science. So could we know this with certainty? Probably not. I mean, it's not going to say Rahab lived here, you know, but it's an interesting possibility that maybe this was her house and did not fall and still exists there today in the ruins. And then verse 24, they burned the city with fire and all that was in it, only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. So again, at this site, there's evidence of fire. There's a burnt layer that goes around the ruins. They found a bunch of these grain storage jars, several dozen of these jars with burned grain still in there. All of that, of course, matches the events that we read of in Joshua chapter 6. And then in verse 25, however, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all that she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates. And so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. Okay, notice there, verse 26, the curse that is put on the city. If you rebuild it, it's going to be at the loss of your sons. And that's exactly what happens later on. 1 Kings 16:34, Hiel the Bethlehite built Jericho. He laid his foundation with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up his gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. So the city was later rebuilt. It cost him his sons, but he rebuilt it. We read about the city of Jericho in the New Testament and Jesus going there and that sort of thing. So that's what happened. That's the events of Joshua chapter 6. Now, here are three things we can learn from it. Number one, no stronghold can resist God. Remember, originally, they sent 12 spies into the promised land. 10 of them came back with the report, we can't do it. You can read in Numbers 13:28, they said, the people who live in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and very large. So they're looking at cities like Jericho and other places like that with these big walls around them. They said they're walled up to heaven. There's no way we can take these guys are big and the cities are walled and there's just no way we can do it. And yet here we are after years of punishment. Now they go and do it, and sure enough, God takes care of them just like he said he would. However big those walls were at Jericho, they didn't pose a problem for God, obviously. And that's one reason Jericho, I think, is so memorable. You know, Israel conquered tons of cities, but this one is so memorable because the walls fell down. That's a pretty unique way to conquer a city. You know, the wall just fell down and you rush in and take the city. And so we remember it for that reason, and we've got songs about it, or we teach our kids in Bible class and the whole nine yards. But Israel, you know, it conquers this walled city. Obviously, this great miracle, but also, for the rest of time, a symbol to us still today of the fact that God is always going to be victorious, that no wall is going to withstand the power of God. Nothing that man can do is going to withstand His power, and it's a symbol of the victory of people who are on God's side. It didn't matter if Jericho's walls were up to heaven, as they said. It didn't matter if Goliath was 10 feet tall. It didn't matter if King Hezekiah was surrounded by Assyrians. None of that stuff matters. If you're on God's side, it doesn't matter. He's powerful enough to bring the victory. When God intervenes, who can resist? Be turning over to 1 John chapter 5, please. That's important for us because when we start reading our New Testaments, we start reading about our adversary. We knew about it from the Old Testament, but it's reiterated again in the New Testament that we have this adversary, the devil, who prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, 1 Peter 5:8. And we wonder, is he going to be too powerful? Does evil have too strong of a hold in this world and in our personal environment, our society, in our community? Look in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 19. The comment is made, we know that we are of God and that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. That's an interesting comment that's made. The whole world lies in the power or the sway of the evil one. You look at our society, especially right now, and you can see that. That so many are influenced by evil and follow the path of evil. You see the chaos and you see the selfishness and you see the violence. It reminds me of how a prophet described the Israelites in the long ago. He said, there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. That's Hosea 4, 1 and 2. Hundreds of years ago. Thousands of years ago. You would think he's talking about today. That's what happens when we forsake the word of the Lord. But for our psyche, for our emotions, we look at the news. We turn on the news and it's disheartening to see one American citizen treating another American citizen like we've been seeing. To see any humans behave like we've been seeing. It's disheartening. And so we see this comment, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. But then verse 20 says, we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know Him who is true, and we are in Him who is true, in His Son Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. Look, there have been enemies before. Jericho is a good reminder. It seemed like God's people didn't stand a chance. What are you going to do? How are you going to get through these walls? What can be done? Fear not. We are with the one true God. He can make walls fall down. He can bring the victory when it seems like there is no victory to be had. Backing up a few pages to James chapter 4 and in verse 7, James 4, 7 says, submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. There's the victory. God will bring the victory. And Jericho is a great reminder that the walls often seem impenetrable, but even though that's the case, God can bring them down. Jericho is a great reminder that even though all evil often seems so strong, God's righteousness will prevail. Jericho is a good reminder that even though I myself am frail, I'm weak, I have problems, God's power provides the victory. And so we read these old stories, and they're memorable because of what happened, the walls falling down. But it reminds us of the power of God and that He can defeat any enemy. That's number one. Number two, from Jericho we learn that God rewards faith wherever it is found. Let's go back to Joshua, this time chapter 2. Let's think about Rahab for a minute. Joshua chapter 2 and in verse 1. Now I mentioned spies earlier. Here's another set of spies sent in. Joshua 2 and verse 1 says that Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shechem, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. You skip down to verse 8, and it says, now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the man, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now that's an interesting statement. And here's Rahab, and she sees these men, and she hides them up on a roof and all that, and she's taking care of them. And now she makes these statements of faith. So I know your God, the God of the Israelites, that's the one true God, the God of heaven and earth. Now Rahab was a harlot. Rahab was a woman of an immoral occupation. Hopefully that would be a thing of the past. But here she is. This is what it is. But she shows her faith here in the one true God, and so she is spared. We read that over here, chapter 6, verse 25. Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now, one of the interesting things is about Rahab, she ends up becoming the great-great-grandmother of King David. And she's in the lineage of Jesus. Matthew chapter 1, there's Rahab in the physical lineage leading down to Jesus. Interesting that she's there. Look over in Hebrews chapter 11. She's also remembered later in the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 11, look at this mention, verses 30 and 31. So I'm in Hebrews 11, verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. And then you flip forward a couple more pages, James chapter 2. In this great section we have about faith and how faith produces obedience, James chapter 2 and in verse 24, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. And so she's an example of having enough faith to take action. Look who's used here in James 2. Here's Abraham. He's one example. Who else? Rahab the harlot? Yeah. God rewards faith wherever it's found. Whatever your past, God sees that glimmer of hope in each one of us. Rahab is a good reminder to us in that way. By the way, I don't think it's necessary to conclude that her lying was approved of by God. It's her faith and her peaceful reception of the spies that's later commended here in the New Testament. Not her lying, certainly not her harlotry. But Rahab is a good reminder for us. Here's someone who needs God in her life, especially because of her past. God's desire is always for people to turn from sin and to Him. Look in the Gospel of Matthew, please, chapter 21. Jesus had told this parable about the two sons, and one said he would go work for his father and then change his mind. The other one said he wouldn't and then changed his mind. But notice then what Jesus says, Matthew 21, 31. Which of the two did the will of the Father? And they said the first. And Jesus said to them, truly I say to you, that the tax collectors and prostitutes will get into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax collectors and prostitutes did believe him. And you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterwards, so as to believe him. Look at Jesus there commending, of all people, of all groups, the tax collectors and the prostitutes for what they were able to understand when John the Baptist had come and taught. If we follow that example, we will look at people's souls with as much love as God does. It would have been very easy to just sweep Rahab the harlot away with everybody else in Jericho. Here's another immoral person. We're just going to sweep her under the rug with everybody else. But God will breathe fresh air into the one who demonstrates faith. And that's a message we have all throughout the Bible, and that's a message that should resonate with each one of us. You and I can always come back to God. If our faith has wavered, if our prayers have been few, if our service has been weak, if our selfishness has been strong, God is ready for us to turn our lives around and come back to Him. He can see that little glimmer of hope that little glimmer of faith, just like Rahab and her confession to the spies there in Joshua chapter 2, he can see that and he wants to fan that into a flame. In fact, Isaiah had foretold about Jesus, a bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. That's Isaiah 42 and verse 3. So whether it's Rahab or whether it's evil King Manasseh, another great story, whether it's a murderous Pharisee named Saul of Tarsus, or you, God sees that little glimmer of hope, and he's willing to forgive, and he's willing to help us grow, and he's willing to reward our faith. What a good God we serve. Aren't we glad he's forgiving? Point number three. This is what we need to understand about Jericho. God can give something with conditions. Look again at our text, please. Joshua chapter 6. Notice the wording that's used in verse 2. Joshua 6 and verse 2. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with his king and his valiant warriors." Okay, so God's going to give them the city. What does God mean when he says that? Are the inhabitants going to vanish? The gates are going to open? They're just going to walk in and take it? How's that going to happen? Well, first he gives them instructions, right? Verse 3, you shall march around the city, all the men of war circling and so forth. All these instructions that they need to follow. You need to do it this way, march in this order, this many times and all this. If we stopped reading at verse 2, we would probably leave with the wrong impression from the text. But he gives them instructions after he says, I'm going to give you the city. Notice the wording again. We drop down to verse 16. Joshua 6 and verse 16. At the seventh time, when the priest blew the trumpet, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." There it is again. He's given it to you. But why does verse 20 say they took the city? Verse 20 said, the people shouted, and the priest blew the trumpets, and when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. ESV said, captured. Well, did God give them the city or did they take the city? Well, both, right? We understand how the story worked out there. It's not one or the other. God gave it to them, but they had to meet some conditions and then actually go and take it. Go backwards a book. Look in Deuteronomy, please, chapter 9. They had to follow the instructions and do the marching, and finally, they had to run in there and fight and conquer the city. And even when they did those things, it's not like they caused the walls to fall down. That was God's power, right? It's not like they by themselves were necessarily victorious. God is the one giving them the city because even when they did those things, God was doing this for them. In fact, back here in Deuteronomy chapter 9, God was making very clear before they go into the promised land. Remember, Deuteronomy is going over the law again before they go into the promised land now, making sure that their thinking is straight. And Moses here reminding them, it's not because of you. It's not because you deserve this. There's something so good about you. You're so righteous. You're so good. You just deserve this promise. God said, no, it's me giving this to you. And he's just reiterating that point. Let's just look at one verse, verse 6. Deuteronomy 9 and verse 6. Know then, it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stubborn people. And so he makes it very clear. We'll put a little chart up here to try to draw the parallel between what we're talking about. It's very clear that God was doing this for them. Now, that helps us. When we get to the New Testament and God starts talking about salvation under the New Covenant, what is God telling us about salvation? In Ephesians chapter 2, let me turn over there and read verses 8 and 9. These verses are as true and as wonderful as they could possibly be. Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9, "For by grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, as it is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast." All right, what's God telling us about salvation? Clearly, God is giving this to us. He says, verse 8, it is the gift of God. And it's not because somehow we are so righteous that we just inherently deserve this wonderful eternal salvation, that we deserved it, that we earned it somehow. Just like the Israelite, he says that in verse 9, not a result of works. You can't boast and brag and say, look what I did. And so just like the Israelites had to walk around Jericho to get the gift God was giving them, you and I have got to walk in newness of life, Romans 6, 4, to get the gift God is giving to us. God can give something and still attach conditions to that gift. We see that in Jericho and lots of other Old Testament stories, and we see that with New Covenant salvation. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21, as Jesus there is teaching And he's drawing the contrast between lip service and obeying the Lord. He says, Matthew 7:21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who's in heaven will enter. Again, just parallel to what they had to do to conquer Jericho. Somebody said, well, I thought salvation was by faith. It is. It is. Ephesians 2:8. But faith includes obedience. In fact, go back to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. We're saved by grace through faith, Ephesians 2:8. Look at Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 30. We read this earlier, but pay more close attention now to the wording. Verse 30, Hebrews 11, 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. How is it using the word? We're not asking what my opinion is about the word faith. How is Hebrews 11, 30 using the word faith? There it's including what they did to get the gift that God was giving to them. They didn't just sit at the edge of the city and believe in God. They did what he instructed them to do. Ephesians 2:8, by grace you've been saved through faith. What does that mean? I don't just sit there and believe that God exists or that he'll save me. I do what he's instructed me to do. And I get the gift God is giving to me. I've got to do the will of my Father, as Jesus said in Matthew 7:21. Joshua 6 preserves a tremendous story for us. I'm so glad we have the story of Jericho. It gives me composure in the face of my enemy. It gives me confidence about myself. And it gives me an example of obedience. What a good God we serve. He loves us. He's ready to give us this gift. We just got to obey his commandments and live with him forever. If there's some way we can help you in a spiritual way, if you want it to be made known publicly, please come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.